to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Our topic for today is creativity. Joining us are Jessica Pickford, Carla Roakes, Holden Hansen, Aaron Vandermeer, and Terrence Dollard. Your host for 30 Brave Minutes is Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Creativity comes in many forms, from the delicate and yet powerful steps, jumps, and landings of a ballerina, to the transporting power of a novel, to take a reader 1,000 miles away and back again in a sea of word pictures so real and powerful that putting the book down becomes a physical impossibility. Who among us doesn't marvel at the work of the great masters when you stroll through the North Carolina Museum of Art or the High in Atlanta? A day without music for me is like a day without sunshine, and for every mood or event or sentiment, we have a playlist or a core set of go-to songs to get us up, mellow us out, or just give us something to think about. In a 1929 interview with the Saturday Evening Post, Albert Einstein noted that imagination, a starting point of the creative process, is as critical to him as a scientist as it would be to anyone in the more traditional humanities. I am enough of the artist, the physicist argued, to draw freely upon my imagination. Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world. Modern media has put the work product of artists of all stripes at our fingertips. Songs, paintings, drama, stand-up comedy, film, comic books, culinary arts, anime, and so many other forms and functions of the creative process are now carried with us for quick sampling as the need and mood requires. 1.3 billion movie tickets were sold in 2016 at an average price hovering closer and closer to $9. A study in Tech Times suggests that as many as 57 million Americans illegally downloaded songs last year to one of their devices, an indication of just how much we want access to our music, the music that we crave, or perhaps that another unique form of American creativity is simply circumventing the law. In short, we're addicted to art in one form or another. Among the most beguiling elements of the creative work of artists is the sense of wonder it provides. Whether it's a play in GPAC, a performance of one of our choirs, ensembles, or jazz groups, or a tour through the Locklear AD Gallery, art in all of its forms on our campus and beyond connects us to a sense of wonder and appreciation for the elements of invention and genius that make a society worth living in. Who hasn't stopped to say at one time or another, "How'd they do that?" Artistry fills our thoughts, frames our conceptualization of the real and the symbolic, informs our judgments, provokes us, soothes us, and transports us. Our topic for today, artistry and creativity. Joining me today are five UNCP faculty who teach, mentor, research, serve, and create. Artistry and creativity comes in many forms and across many platforms. For today's discussion, we have a creative writer, Jessica Pickford, a visual artist, Carla Roakes, an actor-director, Holden Hansen, a musician, Aaron Vandermeer, and a media specialist and comic book artist, Terrence Dollard. Each of our panel are teachers, each are scholars, and each are artists. Let's get started this way. Describe the creative process that you undertake in each of your own areas of expertise. Jessica?
Yeah, so that was a great introduction, and it's super fun to be in a small enclosed space with a bunch of artists, sort of a dream for a lot of artists. You mentioned in our various disciplines, we're, of course, the artist in this room, also being creative at the same time that we're working and being teachers. And so I have to wonder, of course, it's an individualized process, right? This notion of tapping into your creativity and how you're productive at the same time that you're also being professional. And so I think for me, as a writer, I get a lot of inspiration from my students, but also from place and the world around me. And I think I think of writing as a daily practice and empathy, and that's what I try to convey to my students as well. So Yeah, it's about living through another character's shoes and paying attention to the world around you.
Well, my form of creativity lies in visual arts, and so creativity in visual arts is often an immersive process. Quite often when you put yourself in a studio space, you lose your sense of self. Some people call it a flow state, where you lose sense of time or place. And so I suppose creativity for visual artists is about finding that place where somewhere between thinking and producing where you can lose yourself in your process and the act of making. And for me, drawing, painting, and digital arts are my media, and my process involves blending those to kind of deconstruct and then reconstruct and recontextualize an image to create an interchangeable narrative. So for me, the creative process is about that immersive experience of losing a sense of self in a way.
I think for the musician, it can be different depending on what you're doing, whether you're composing or whether you're performing notes on a page with other musicians, or whether you are improvising. I think all those creative processes can manifest themselves differently. But I think what it comes down to is a single point for all the musicians. I think the creative process begins with listening for inspiration. If you're a jazz musician, you want to do an existing song differently than it's been done before. Still listening to other styles of music, other musicians, maybe even seeing visual art can all help, because that can translate into rhythm, like it famously has for Beethoven when he would go on long walks and hear birds chirping. That would be either rhythm or pitch for him. And for the jazz musician who's the improviser, you're just really trying to hear sound in the moment and keep all your senses awake. Cannonball Adderley, the great saxophonist, used to keep his eyes wandering around the room, and if he saw, a lady in a red dress walk in, he would perhaps quote a song that had a lady in a red dress for a theme. So I guess for me, it just boils down to keeping your ears open.
You know, when you're working in television, you're working with a lot of other people. So you have to be able to take your ideas and make it something that you can explain to a group of people who help you realize your vision. So even if you are working on a documentary or working on a music video, you still need people to either be your subject, and that requires all the prepping and the planning and the phone calls. So it's always a challenge to get to the point where you can actually be creative, because you do so much administrative work prior to that. And that's why when I get home, I like to draw comics, because the only person I have to explain it to is myself. And sometimes I understand that. Other times it's just a bunch of lines that you erase. But it's a great outlet that kind of is a two-dimensional TV substitute. So in terms of creativity, it would be great to be able to, as Aaron was saying, just listen to the rest of your ensemble and maybe pick something up. But in television, you really have to sort of come up with that vision and be able to translate it to a group and work on it sometimes months after you had that initial thought.
Well, I guess I was asked to participate in this because I am a theater practitioner, but my first instinct in thinking about creativity was that it isn't just in the domain of the arts. Creativity is necessary for non-artistic activity, and I find myself spending more time on non-artistic activity than I do artistic activity in my job as a faculty member. So my next step was to sort of think about, it seems to me that my creativity engages when I'm writing proposals for curriculum changes, when I'm trying to figure out how to teach a concept. And that requires a lot of thinking. But once the thinking is done, then it seems like I start moving into a non-thinking mode. And I think that's sort of related to flow, as Carla was talking about. And I believe that my when I work on a play and working with actors, I'm engaged in this thinking, but then it eventually moves into this mode of not thinking. So that's how I relate to creativity.
One of the things that we all suffer with, whether we are trying to be creative for a living or trying to get to a finish line, is the inevitable creative barrier. You have the makings of an imagination or a vision to lead you in some direction, but something is stopping. What do each of y'all do individually in your own work when you get to that place where you're stuck and you need to break through a barrier?
I find if I'm writing a script or if I'm editing a project and it just doesn't seem to be going anywhere, I try and get to a point where at least I've said all that I can say at that moment, and then I will do anything else for, you know, half an hour or so, whether it's pick up an instrument and play some music for a while or walk the dog or if I'm at work, you know, go around and talk to a colleague. And I got a piece of advice years ago from a professor who worked as a professional screenwriter, and his advice was, when you get stuck, do something else because your mind will solve the problem without you even trying. And I find that actually works. I will just go out and do anything else. I could go grocery shopping, and when I come back, maybe now I've got one little piece that will, you know, get the avalanche started and I can get back to work again.
Yeah, I think Terrence put that really well. That translates very well to music, at least in my experience. Some things that musicians have tried to do to get out of ruts is they've tried practicing 14, 16 hours a day. And sometimes that can work as if they're going to will themselves out of that rut, and sometimes it causes physical problems and they keep digging deeper into the rut. Some musicians have historically tried drugs and gotten deep into drugs, as Charlie Parker did, and that was a rut that he couldn't get out of. He died when he was 34. And I think it all comes back to, again, just listening to different types of music, because musicians have been stuck in ruts forever. Beethoven was not always writing his A material, as my teacher David Baker used to remind me frequently. And the answers are in the sound that is now, as Jeff mentioned, very easy for us to access. And then, of course, we have our colleagues, too, who have been there before, and they know the way out of the hole sometimes. Between listening and talking to colleagues, I think that's a good way out of creative ruts.
I try not to force things. I try to have patience. I know that eventually it's going to come just from experience. I know that's going to happen. So I think that's basically it. I try to have patience, and I try to get plenty of sleep.
I'm going to be patient, and I'm going to be patient right now.
usually when I come across a creative barrier, it's because I'm overthinking it. And quite often what I try to do is just kind of pull back and either, you know, go for a walk, observe art, go to a museum, a gallery, listen to music, spend time with my children because, you know, they're a huge source of inspiration, but also just do some automatic drawing or something that pulls ideas from my subconscious and not really try to think about it too much. Because process is really what matters, and getting back into the actual making and not trying to think about the concept too much is what I try to do. So,
yeah, my mom says a walk will solve any problem. Mm-hmm. So I go on a lot of walks. I also had a mentor long ago who said there's no such thing as writer's block. It's just laziness. And I think there's some truth to that. You can always find a way out of a creative rut, whether it's getting physically outside of your space or as you mentioned, doing something different, right? I think students often want prescriptive advice, so, you know, how can I be super productive? How can I publish this? How can I? And, of course, it's a subjective process. You find the regimen that works for you. Some writers write in spurts. Others go for months sometimes without really working on a longer project. But then just being open to open to the experience and the muse, I guess, if you will, when it comes. And then also prompts and writing exercises. So we do a lot in my classes, my workshops, of fixed form narratives, and sometimes having that prescriptive direction. So you have to work within a set word count or base it off of, you know, a particular image or go on a walk and record what you see. I think sometimes that can generate creativity when you weren't, you know, pointedly looking for it.
I do a lot of interviews with comic book writers and artists who have a deadline every month. They have to do however many scripts or however many pages they have to draw. And the one thing they always say is that when they get stuck, they just have to, whatever it is, they just have to keep working and eventually trust that the talent will come through and that what they're trying to do will be okay because, after all, they're professionals. And I had one colleague say something about, you know, no one has plumber's block. You know, you never hear about the plumber who can't work today. I just don't feel the pipes. So, you know, you're not an aspiring jogger. You either jog or you do, or you don't jog, rather. So a lot of the pros that I have spoken to usually just say, when it doesn't feel right, you just keep working and trust that you'll go back to it and fix it later on, but you just force your way through it.
That kind of leads me to another idea, and I deal with this when I'm trying to write and to try to connect some ideas to some real people who lived in the past. How do you know when something you're working on is done? I mean, how do you know when you've gotten to the point where you're like, okay, this is what I imagined, and when do you stop grinding to get it to where you want, and when do you say, okay, it's done?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think especially for improvising musicians, there's no real concept of being done. Improvisation is a lifelong pursuit, and it evolves as you evolve. And so in that way, there's no concept of being done. But for a composer, perhaps, I can imagine perhaps it's a lot like being a visual artist, and you hear about the brushstroke that ruined the painting. And I think composers get to be like that too. But, you know, if we're going to live and work in an economy, we eventually need to be done and move to the next thing. So I think it's more of a temporal thing of when is this done and when is it not? And you have to move on for other considerations because I could be working on something forever.
Yeah, I agree with Aaron. I mean, not to use a cliche, but it'll tell you when it's done. Usually when you finish a work, you just know the moment you finish it that you don't need to add anything or edit anything out. So that's what I rely on, is my instinct as an artist, to let the work kind of speak to that. But for digital media, you can do several variations of a work and really have many different options. So it depends on the process and the material that you're using, I think.
In the theater, there's a deadline. It's opening night.
The show must go on.
You know, as a director, you're sort of done by opening night. As an actor, however, you continue to be in the show night after night, and we try to create the illusion that it's happening for the first time. And each work of art, night after night, it changes depending on the audience. And so I suppose that as an actor, you're not really ever done. You're just sort of constantly creating it in the moment.
I think what Holden was saying makes a lot of sense for television. If the 6 o'clock news is supposed to go on at 6 o'clock, doesn't matter if you don't feel like going on at 6 o'clock. It has to be 6 o'clock, so you have all your work done before then. So the work is usually done either when the client hands you the check and that commercial goes on the air, whether or not you are totally pleased with it, or when the deadline is for the air date or something. If it's something that I'm working on very personally, I usually give myself several deadlines so I can put it down for a few weeks and look at it with a fresh set of eyes, because I tend to lose perspective staring at the screen for days, hours at a time. So if I can look at it later on, I can make changes and say, oh, this works, this doesn't work, and keep tweaking it. But then the end result is that you're never finished, and then they put you in a pine box.
Carla, a few minutes ago, you mentioned sometimes you can find inspiration from your kids.
Yeah.
Where else do y'all find inspiration? And when you get it, if it doesn't come at a time where you can immediately do something with it, how do you hold on to that moment?
I usually find it from contemporary art. I love to go to museums and galleries and just look at art. So quite often I'll just carry a sketchbook with me and write it down. I have a terrible memory, so I have to write things down. And then draw as well. I will go to a museum or gallery and sit and draw ideas out, break a composition down by shapes and movement and colors, and just kind of resynthesize it, gives me ideas, and that's where I draw inspiration.
I'm directing Uncle Vanya right now, and in this particular production, I'm drawing a huge amount of inspiration from a film that was done in the early 90s called Vanya on 42nd Street, and they're actually using the same text that I'm using, and I'm not bashful about stealing ideas whenever I can, and of course, we sort of use it as a springboard, and we jump off from that, and it kind of takes on a life of its own. I also teach my students, my acting students, that they can draw inspiration from each other, their acting partner. If they are not open to that, if they're sort of working too much solo on their own on stage, they're liable to not find inspiration. But if they're tuned into their acting partner, they're going to discover that the work of acting becomes quite easy because you're just responding in the moment to what the other actor is doing.
Yeah, I think for most musicians, the way they find inspiration is simply from listening to other musicians, beautiful sounds, impressive technique, and outside the preferred genre for the musician too is a great thing. I can always go hear someone and say, wow, you know, I hadn't thought of that. I haven't heard that sound before. I really like the way they did this tune. That sound was amazing. And so that's always a great inspiration. Dizzy Gillespie made an interesting comment one time. He said, I'm not really that interested in music. I'm interested in sound. And he made the distinction between music and sound, which I think was a very creative way to think about what he was hearing and what he was putting into his own music.
That's fascinating.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment, but first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. Please consider a contribution to the Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope to Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNCP, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
Let's shift gears a little bit, because I think teaching is by its nature a creative process, or at least it certainly should be. But you all are in the unique position of helping to teach people how to be creative, not just to understand a certain flow or a certain process, but how to do that organically on their own. How do you teach people to be creative?
For me, the vehicle of the jazz combo is an inherently perfect vehicle for teaching creativity. Because it's not desirable in jazz to do something the same way that it has been done. You need to learn the way it has been done, but you are encouraged to have a different voice. You don't need to sound like every other guitar player. You don't need to sound like every trumpet player. Every sound, every voice individually is valued in jazz, and you don't want to duplicate someone else. So I think as a pedagogue, the most important thing I can do is actually step out of the way of the students. I think the creativity is inherent in all human beings, and I think the process of you know, student sitting in a classroom and authority figure teacher standing up front telling them what needs to know in many ways stifles creativity, even though we're bestowing knowledge and giving them hints to, you know, this is really important for you. You should learn this. But at some point, I think you need to, as an educator, you need to step out of the way. And once you do, the students fill up that space with their own thoughts and their own experience. So it's been impressive for me. Sometimes I will just sit in a combo rehearsal totally silent and watch the students act. And they come up with all kinds of great ideas that I wouldn't have thought of. And that's been a good lesson for me, that sometimes the best thing I can do as an educator is stay out of the way.
I think you can teach technique and skill, and as students build their skill, they build their confidence. But teaching them creativity is a challenge because basically what that is to me is encouraging them to be curious, relentless, persevere, move through any doubts, and take risks. And that's what we do as artists. We just have to have faith that we can do what drives us and not question it. And creativity is definitely something that, you know, you have to develop from within. And many of the students pick that up as they develop their skills, their skill sets, and strengthen their process. They just kind of intuitively start to make from a place within.
Yeah, I don't think I can teach creativity. I heard parts of both of your answers that I identify with. I think you can enable it, sort of encourage it, but I just think that creativity is something that we're born with. It's not something that can be taught necessarily.
I think the arts are a fundamental part of a college education, of any education for that matter. I think they teach meaning. I think they teach abstract thought. I think people who have an appreciation for art in all of its forms think more creatively. I think they're better problem solvers. I think they think more deeply and more critically about any range of things. Let me give you all a chance to answer that question. Tell me why the arts are critical to a college education.
Well, arts-based learning is critical. I know STEM is a very important topic among college campuses and administrators, but arts-based learning is important because it encourages soft skills, observation, listening, working collaboratively among a variety of different people, diverse people, to solve a problem and thinking outside of the box. And I think arts-based learning promotes that kind of learning, of activity among students. And I also believe that careers are changing, and many of the skills that students are going to need in the future will require creative thinking. And I think arts-based learning is crucial.
Back in the early 90s, I worked at the Arts Council of Fayetteville. I became curious about Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, which includes intrapersonal, interpersonal, kinesthetic, spatial, logical, mathematical, and I can't name them all, but I grew enamored of these ideas because I sort of sensed that I have these intelligences, that we all have all of these intelligences, and I think that the arts, maybe more than other subject matters, tends to engage the kinesthetic, the spatial, the interpersonal, the intrapersonal. And so I think that promotes that kind of learning. It helps to build those intelligences that all humans have.
I think that one of the things that I would add is that the arts are really, along maybe with mathematics, they seem like the only universal language. They're the only commodity that you can go into the middle of Russia with and have people understand you or perhaps not understand you, but attempt to communicate with you in a nonverbal language that does not require you to be able to cognate the words being said. Now, there is other kinds of cognition. You cognate a beautiful melody. Music works in the brain the same way language does and really is another language. But I I see that really translating among visual art, dance, theater. Meaning can be enhanced if you understand a language that is being spoken, but there's plenty of beauty there without it.
I really appreciated your response about the kinesthetic experience because you're in theater, and I think that truly is important. But also, I think art-based learning is important because it produces leaders. You know, I think taking risk and being innovative and seeing something to fruition and bringing it full circle takes, you know, creativity. And so that's another thought I had.
Well, let's close with a final question going in a little different direction. Each of you are artists. Talk about one artist, maybe living or dead, that you would love to have worked alongside with or to have spent some time at the very least talking with. Who would be that person for each of y'all?
That one's easy for me, even though, of course, there's a great myriad of people to choose from, but I would choose Louis Armstrong. He's very interesting to me because he came up in the worst of situations and ended up in the best of situations and brought happiness and joy to people around the world, became very wealthy but never displayed or really used his wealth. He grew up poor in New Orleans. He didn't have shoes. The streets were made of broken oyster shells. His mother had to work sometimes as a part-time prostitute to be able to feed her children. He got arrested when he was 12 for firing a gun into the sky on New Year's Eve, as was customary. But the white policeman didn't like a young black man doing this, so they hauled him off to the Home for Colored Waifs, where he really got into music and went from one instrument to the other. And by the end of the year, after he'd picked up his cornet, and his heroes were cornetists, he was leading the band, walking around town, and became really the king of the city before he was 18, and then went up to Chicago. And then the rest was sort of history. But, you know, the State Department used him on tours. He was a goodwill ambassador. He brought the passion and joy and the sound of freedom to people across the world and really exemplified it in his life.
Well, I've always had a fantasy of being in a rock band. I'm not a musician, so if I may, I think
absolutely
David Bowie, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, but none of these people are in my discipline. As far as theater is concerned, probably it's the person that whose work I'm working on at the moment. So I'll just say Anton Chekhov. He was ahead of his time. He wrote a subtler form of realism when startling climaxes like suicides and gunshots were sort of the norm in plays. And he had a kind of a tragicomic vision of the world, which I share, that life is rather absurd and therefore comic, but also tragic because we sort of get up every day and struggle and we don't really know to what end that's going to be. So I'd like to get into Anton's head and talk to him about those kinds of things, I suppose.
It's a really difficult question because there's a lot of influences. My current work is influenced. I'm doing two different types of work right now, film, experimental film, and collage. And my collage pieces are influenced by a Venezuelan-based artist, Arturo Herrera, whose work is really about process. It's figurative abstraction, which is what I'm doing. But so much as is a trompe l'oeil effect, like what's real and what's photographed, and his process is very interesting to me, and so I'm really studying that. And then Stan Breckage is another artist from the 60s who produced really interesting films involving light and direct animation on 16-millimeter film. So I'm really studying their process right now. Not so much their background, but they're both very interesting to me.
Well, this has been great fun today. Special thanks to our panel of artists, and thanks to all of you for listening to 30 Brave Minutes. I hope we gave you something to think about. We'll be back next month with another topic from the College of Arts and Sciences.
Today's podcast was produced by Dr. Richard Gay and transcribed by Ms. Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!